You're listening to the Fueled and Free podcast. I'm your host, Margaret, a holistic nutritionist, bringing you real talk and thought-provoking conversations on food, the wellness world, women's health topics, and life. Remember, the information shared in this podcast is not to be taken as individual or medical advice. Welcome back to the podcast. So today's podcast guest is Dr. Jen Simmons. She is the founder of Real Health MD, which is an online virtual practice, and she's a functional medicine doctor. She's also about to release a book coming early May called The Smart Woman's Guide to Breast Cancer. Dr. Simmons was one of the leaders in breast surgery and cancer care in Philadelphia for over 17 years, and she took a very conventional approach to navigating breast cancer. That is, until she got her own breast cancer diagnosis a handful of years ago. And that stopped her in her tracks and really made her question everything about the mainstream approach to cancer and breast health. And she shares a lot about what that experience was like and what her former training was and her skill set and how she pivoted into functional health. She's all about the idea of pursuing health rather than treating illness and has fully immersed herself in the study of functional medicine. And now what she does is she helps women navigate a breast cancer diagnosis from a more integrative and functional approach. I brought her on the podcast today because I personally have a family history of breast cancer, and I've witnessed breast cancer affect those really close around me. And I wanted to know more about the preventative side, about should we get mammograms? What about ultrasound? What about thermography? I wanted to hear more of her perspective on the role of genetics in breast cancer. What are the top things that are really driving breast cancer? Do we need to do chemo and double mastectomy and radiation the second that we get a breast cancer diagnosis? And she dives into all of these different questions that I know I've had, and I know a lot of my audience has had. I've dialogued about this on Instagram stories in the past when I was considering getting my own mammogram. My doctor has recommended that I get a mammogram based on family history. However, at this point in time, I have chosen to not pursue a mammogram. And I think after listening to this episode, maybe that will kind of influence how you decide to do preventative screenings for breast cancer. Anyways, check out the show notes for additional resources. As always, you can follow along on Instagram. Check out Dr. Jen's book when it comes out in a few weeks. I'll be linking that in the show notes, and go give her a follow on Instagram as well. Thanks so much and hope you enjoy. All right. Well, Dr. Jen, welcome to the Fueled and Free podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm excited more for myself, but I know for my audience listening, to ask all these different questions that we have surrounding preventative breast cancer screening, mammogram versus thermography versus ultrasound. You know, what happens when you get the diagnosis? Should you jump right into chemo and radiation? What are our different alternative options? I wanted to kind of start this off though by, first of all, opening up to you to share a little bit more about your story of kind of how you got into what you're doing now. I know you have your own personal cancer situation that you navigated a few years ago, right? When was that? How many years ago?
Yeah, so that was 2016, 17, 18. It took me a while to figure my stuff out. And for me, things actually got a lot worse before they got better, largely because I was trying to navigate things on my own. I just didn't know enough to know who to reach out to and which way I wanted to go. Because I come from a very, very conventional medical background and only learned about who I really was at the core in the journey of my own illness. So I always knew that breast cancer called me. So I really don't remember a time in my childhood when I didn't know about breast cancer. It's part of the thread of the fabric of my family.
Wow.
And literally in every generation, there were a number of women with breast cancer, many of which died of breast cancer. And so the prevalence in my family was tremendous. And as a child, I had a first cousin. Her name was Linda Creed. She was a singer-songwriter in the 1970s and 1980s. She wrote all the music for the Spinners and the Stylistics. She was the queen of Motown sound in Philadelphia. She was beautiful, brilliant, larger than life, lit up a room when she walked in. She was my hero.
Aw.
She wrote 54 hits in all.
Wow.
And her most famous song was The Greatest Love of All. So she wrote that song in 1977 as the title track to the movie The Greatest, starring Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. But it really received its acclaim in March of 1986 when Whitney Houston would release that song to the world. And at that time, it would spend 14 weeks at the top of the charts. Only my cousin would never know, because Linda died of metastatic breast cancer just 1 month after Whitney released that song.
Wow.
I was 16 years old when my hero died. Her life, and ultimately her death, gave birth to my life's purpose. Because I never wanted another woman, another family, another community to have to suffer the way that my family suffered. Mm-hmm. And so I did the only thing I knew how to do. I became a doctor. I was the first doctor in my family. Mm-hmm. I became a surgeon. I became the first fellowship-trained breast surgeon in Philadelphia. And I did that for a really long time, and I did it really well. Mm-hmm. I did it long enough for my aunt to be diagnosed. I did it long enough for my mother to be diagnosed. And to me, breast cancer wasn't an if, it was a when. And I was in my 15th year of practice, and I'll preface this by saying that my aunt, who I'm most genetically alike, 10 years before her breast cancer diagnosis, she was diagnosed with Graves' disease.
Interesting.
And I went from probably being one of the most high-functioning human beings you've ever met, and like, seriously, able to leap a tall building in a single bound, like Superwoman, with all of these balls in the air, and being a surgeon and running the cancer program for my hospital, and being a wife and a mother and a stepmother and an athlete and a philanthropist and a writer. And I mean, I'm doing all of these things. And I go from being able to do all of these things really well to being able to do nothing at all. And I was actually on the tennis court, and I thought I was having a heart attack. I mean, I had no breath in my body. I couldn't walk across the room. And I thought, yeah, like, this is what a heart attack feels like, and this is it for me. And I had a 3-day really intensive workup. And at the end of that 3 days, I'm sitting in the office of my friend and colleague and physician, and he tells me that I need surgery and chemo radiation and lifelong thyroid hormone replacement. And if I don't do this, I'm going to die. And I know that these are things that I say all day, every day, without hesitation or reservation. I know that I have said those exact words to my patients. If you don't do this, you're going to die. And yet, when those words are coming at you, no matter who you are, it is an entirely different experience to hear them as a patient than it is to say them as a physician. And that transition from doctor to patient opened my eyes in a way that would have never and could have never happened had this not happened to me. I refused treatment.
Wow.
My physician, who was my friend, didn't know what to do with me.
I was going to say, what were your colleagues? I'm sure they knew.
Early on, I hid lots of things really well. I would blame a tremor in my hand or too much coffee. I was not forthcoming about what was happening to me with a lot of people, mostly because, you know, I held a really high position, and no one wants to know that their doctor is sick. And again, things did get worse for me before they got better. But I was very fortunate that very early on in my journey, I'm sitting in a lecture hall and this tall, lanky guy walks on the stage with a big toothy grin and he introduces himself as a functional medicine physician. And at this point, I'm a physician for 20 years. So I'm like, yeah, what is this quack talking about?
Yeah.
And then I remember that I'm sick and I'm there for a reason. And so I check my ego at the door and I shut up and I listen because a man on the stage is Mark Hyman.
Oh, no way.
That's and awesome. Though I had never heard of him,
yeah,
millions and millions of people had. And he had already written probably 7 or 8 of his books by that point. And what he said would forever change my life because what he allowed me to recognize in that space and in that time and in that moment was that we're all focused on the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
We're focused on the symptom, but the symptom isn't the problem. It wasn't my problem and it wasn't my patient's problem. So he allowed me to see for the first time how to be a healer. Now, I was tasked with the job of healing myself because that had to happen.
Right.
But then I had this amazing opportunity to heal the world and to change the way that we approach, diagnose, treat, reverse, and screen for breast cancer. And so it really allowed me to fulfill what had always been a lifelong mission for me, in the way that was actually going to fulfill that mission, in a way that was actually going to be productive. So I had a huge revelation that day and in that space. And I still, even though it was 7 years ago, I still feel every single thing about that day. And I'm an early adopter. I get really excited about things. And I'm one of those people that once I know, I know.
Yeah.
So I enrolled in the Institute for Functional Medicine that day, and I spent the next 3 years immersed in the study of functional medicine, got my certification, and decided that that's where my life was meant to go. And I left surgery. I resigned from my position. My colleagues thought that I either lost my mind, lost my skills, or both. I went from being the smartest person in the room to the craziest person in the room. And you know what? That's all okay.
Yeah.
It's all okay because I know that I'm on the right side of history here. The world is changing. It's maybe not changing fast enough for me or you or the people that are awake, but it's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have never felt the kind of excitement that I feel about what I do now when I was doing it then. Now, don't get me wrong. Being a surgeon is one of the greatest privileges that anyone could ever enjoy. God gave me a tremendous gift, an ability to practice a skill with my hands and my mind that few people have, and put me in a position where people give me the ultimate trust because they go to sleep and they literally leave their lives in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no greater gift. And I loved doing it. And I loved the privilege of doing that. And even that is a fraction of the illumination that I get from what I do now.
I can tell. I can feel it. You're inspired and I have like chills from your story. Truly. I can tell that you are lit up and passionate about what you do. It really shows.
Yeah. But, you know, I know as well as anyone else that healing is a journey.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a destination. And it is a constant, constant battle. And, you know, I say all the time, I walk the line. Because unfortunately, I come from a family and genetics isn't everything, but it's something.
Mm-hmm.
And people with bad genetics have to be that much more careful. Can you overcome your genetics? 100%. But you can't overcome your genetics on Twizzlers and Cheetos, right? You can't overcome your genetics sitting your butt in a chair all day. You can't overcome your genetics working around the clock and burning your candle at both ends. You can't overcome your genetics in a toxic environment. You can't overcome your genetics while you're stuck in bad, dangerous relationships, right? Like all of this has to be super acknowledged. I don't want to say controlled because we can't control everything, right? But you have to be so conscious about it. And you have to make conscious decisions all the time as to, is this going to promote my health or is this going to be a blocker to my health, a detriment to my health, right? An impediment to my health. And that's happening all day in my brain, all day, and has to. Because when I let go, I'm rewarded with pain, inflammation, and, you know, that cycle is very dangerous for me because I have to claw my way out. And for every day that I don't heed my own warnings, I suffer for three.
Yeah.
I walk the line, and a lot of people walk the line. A lot of people with poor genetics walk the line, and I'm right there.
Yep. I totally, totally can relate. I actually wanted to ask your thoughts on, okay, if there's the genetic history and the familial history with breast cancer or any sort of estrogenic cancer, really, are you a big fan of the genetic testing?
I'm a big fan of genetic testing, but not in the way that you're referring to it. And when you talk about genetic predisposition to breast cancer, and you happen to mention estrogenic breast cancer, as it turns out, the real risk factor for a genetic tie to breast cancer is the triple negative breast cancer. That's one that's more associated with a BRCA1 or a BRCA2 mutation. We have to remember is that these mutations are in tumor suppressor genes. These are our like protective genes. These are the genes that are going around the body saying, wait, there's a mistake here. Let's fix it. And certain people are born with a defect in that gene. It's not working as well. It's not as efficient. And that person is especially sensitive to environmental insults. Now, we know that just having that gene mutation alone is not enough to get a breast cancer diagnosis or an ovarian cancer diagnosis or a prostate cancer diagnosis.
Correct.
Because there's something else in play there. Not everyone with those genetic mutations gets the disease. And there are some diseases, these are like autosomal dominant diseases, that everyone with the gene gets the disease. This is not one of those cases, okay? This is the case that there is a high penetrance, meaning that there are a lot of people with these genetic mutations that do end up with the disease, but that's because they're not aware of the things that they can do to control their environment. So I'll give you a perfect example with people with BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations. These are people that are identified as high risk and told to start to screen early. So what do? We give them mammograms. We subject them to radiation. We give them MRIs. We subject them to gadolinium. And now we have essentially guaranteed that they're going to develop the disease because we are contributing to their toxic burden. And we are doing that to a population of people who have already shown us, they've already demonstrated they cannot handle excess toxic burden. So the way that we approach that mutation carrier population is completely wrong. And I wholly and totally object to how we've handled that whole situation. So now you did ask me if I'm a fan of genetic testing. The kind of genetic testing that I'm a fan of is how do we take that information and create an environment that nurtures our nature? So I'm a huge fan of genetic testing if it's actionable. Yeah. If you could take that information and do something useful with it. So I use the DNA 360 test because they only test 100 genes. That's true. But they only test those 100 genes because those are the actionable genes. And we want to be able to do something with the information. I use the nutrition genome test because even though it's not every gene, but these are the genes that are actionable, that we can take that information and make changes to eat in the way that is good for our bodies, to move in the way that is good for our bodies, to sleep in the way that is good for our bodies, because this is how we build health. And it's an active process, but you need to know what to do. And it's not one size fits all. There's no one diet that's good for everyone. There's no one way to move that's good for everyone. And so learning about yourself, learning how you detox, learning how what you need for sleep. Like some people, they have really good sleep genes. They do fine no matter what. And other people have terrible sleep genes. These are the people that night shift work is disastrous for them. Doing things that are excitable at night is disastrous for them. Crossing time zones, disastrous for them, right? And so we need to know who we are so that we can know what to do to best promote our health. And I think that that is the value in genetic testing, not in knowing a bunch of things that you can't do anything about, but having actionable genetic testing that can help you to make the decisions to promote your health and be the best version of you that you can be to nurture your nature.
So is this the type of thing that someone could come to your practice to do before they get a breast cancer diagnosis? Like, for example, myself, I'm 37. I have family history of breast cancer on my dad's side. My cousin, who's 41 now, was diagnosed last summer. Early stages, she did double mastectomy, no chemo, moved on, right? But I did genetic testing just for the BRCA gene with my OBGYN and tested negative for those. So did my sister. So did my aunt. But I am curious on further genetic testing. So do you work with a population of people that are more in that kind of proactive space, preventative, worried about a breast cancer diagnosis coming because there's 3+ women on their side of the family that has had it or passed away from it?
Yeah. So I would love to say that people engage me in a preventative kind of way, but they don't.
No. Oh. Yeah.
People only come to me when the proverbial shit has hit the fan, right? Like, no one wants to pay complete attention to their health until they're forced to do it.
I know.
Everyone, you know, before then, you're just kind of, you know, going through the motions.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that will be okay. Now that's changing. That's changing. And it's changing because our numbers of breast cancer are skyrocketing. Our numbers of cancer are skyrocketing.
That's colon cancer too.
The number is going to become 1 in 2 pretty soon. Right now it's 1 in 3. Yeah. 1 in 3 people in their lifetime will have cancer. It's getting very close to being 1 in 2. These are frightening numbers, but this is our environment.
Mm-hmm.
This is our environment. This is our toxic environment, which is such a huge departure from what our bodies are built for and meant for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for so many reasons, but we are living so far from how and what we were supposed to live like. We are modern beings living on a very old gene code. And the one thing that I see that is so glaring, I mean, besides the processed food, which is a huge problem, beside the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, you know, all the preservatives that are a huge problem, besides all the toxins in our environment, the xenoestrogens, the plastics, the fragrances, the antibiotics, the xenobiotics, like besides all of those toxic things that we all know are bad for us, the invisible toxin that I think is probably having the greatest effect, the greatest detrimental effect on our health is the stress factor.
Oh, amen. I was hoping you were going to say that. I was like,
yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, we really only understand two states. We understand danger and we understand safety, right? And in danger, we are cortisol dominant beings. That's our stress hormone. And that is what is dominating our physiology at that time. When we're in safety, we're in parasympathetic mode, we're in rest, repair, digest. That is where we're supposed to live. We're supposed to live there 95% of the time. We're only built for that danger mode a very short period of time, 5% of the time. And if you think about it, what were our stressors when we were first inhabiting this earth, right? Saber-tooth tigers, we didn't have that many stressors.
Right.
I mean, maybe we stressed about food scarcity and the people that could withstand food scarcity and be able to load up when food was abundant. Like that was definitely a survival mechanism, which is why our obesity gene is such a problem now, because those were the people that survived. The people that were able to store it up so that they could get through the times of scarcity, that's the people that survived. Unfortunately, we don't have winter anymore, right? We only have abundance. We don't have scarcity. So now that obesity gene is a huge problem, which is not to say that obesity is a genetic problem. It is not. But that, you know, that's kind of where that comes from.
Right.
But my point is that, you know, we didn't have that many threats. We didn't have that much danger. We had come out of the cave in the morning, encounter saber-toothed tiger, run like hell to get away from the tiger. But, you know, in 15 seconds or less than a minute, that was all over with. You either escaped or you were dead. But there was no running away from the saber-toothed tiger for 3 hours or 3 days or 3 months or 3 weeks or 3 years. Like, it didn't happen. And yet, in modern times, we are surrounded by saber-toothed tigers.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in all different forms. Their deadlines, their difficult relationships, they're pulling all-nighters, they're working too hard, they're whatever they are. Our body doesn't understand the difference between a tiger and our cell phone. It doesn't understand the difference between a tiger and an awful relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's weighing on you, it's weighing on you. If it's draining you, it's draining you. And you can only fight for so long. And most of us are like 50-50 in sympathetic versus parasympathetic. And that is not an equation that works. We are not built for that. So when we are in that cortisol dominant state, there are a lot of things that happen that are very good in the short run and not good in the long run. So in the short run, yes, if you have to run away from a tiger, you need all the blood diverted to your muscles, right? So when you do that, you take blood flow away from the brain because it doesn't want you to think like, should I run this way? Should I run this way? It just wants you to run, right? So shut off the thinking part of your brain and turn on that monkey brain that like, just go. But that monkey brain doesn't serve us most of the time, right? That monkey brain gets us into a lot of trouble. And thinking about it just from the breast standpoint, it shuts off blood flow to the breast. Well, if you shut off blood flow to the breast, you're not carrying the toxins away. So the toxins are just there bathing the breast cells in toxic soup. This is a problem. This is why stress causes breast cancer, right? And on top of that, you know, that alone in a vacuum will not cause breast cancer. But the most important thing that we see in association with being in this sympathetic state for so long is that if you are running away from a saber-toothed tiger, your body does not have to worry about the common cold. So what happens is part of that cortisol dominant state is you're flipping off your immune system. Because you don't need your immunity if you're about to get eaten by a tiger. Like if you survive the tiger and everything goes back to normal, we'll turn your immune system on again. But right now we need all hands on deck to get away from said tiger. So we're all walking around in this immunocompromised state because we are so turned on by our cortisol. And this is a problem because we need our immune system, because our immune system is part of that system that goes and surveys the body and says, is this cell healthy? Is it not? If it's not healthy, I'm going to get rid of it. But if it's so exhausted or if it's not on because you have too much stress in your life, that process isn't going to happen. And that cancer cell, which should have been destroyed in its infancy, is allowed to grow and divide. And everything it gives rise to does the same thing. Divide, divide, divide. So what we all need is to get back to safety. We all need to find safety and be in that safe space all the time so that our breast feels safe, so our body feels safe, so our immune system can come back online. I mean, this is a really, really important aspect, and we don't talk about it enough. And it's because I think that people don't understand the direct relationship between stress and why your health fails.
I think what I'm observing, I work with quite a few women in the 30 to 50 age group. You know, I'm 37, and I don't think I realized until my kids started elementary school, mine are 8 and 10, and I have a lot of clients kind of in the similar boat where we're raising kids, we're working careers, lots of things going on, is you don't realize until you've backed yourself into a corner with your schedule, your work, the activities, the obligations, and you don't know how to dig out. I don't think there's enough talked about of how much every yes is a no to something else. And just the importance of, like, one of the things we're talking about as a family right now, because we just moved. And we're starting from scratch with everything in a new school, in a new town, with new friends, is we're being very careful on what we're putting on the calendar and what we're saying yes to, because we had backed ourselves into a crazy schedule when we were living back in Pennsylvania. And it's very difficult to dig out of that crazy busy.
You're not just whistling Dixie, honey.
No,
I know.
You know, you're up at 5:30 and get the kids up and lunches and work.
Yep.
And you relax until your head hits the pillow and you're doom scrolling for an hour before bed and you're unwinding with a glass of wine because your day was insane.
Yeah. And then you get up and do it again the next day.
And again.
And it goes back to, you asked me, like, don't people come to you for prevention? And the reason is, as you're seeing, you don't realize you're in trouble until you're in trouble. And it's not going to happen to me is the prevailing sentiment. Like, I've got this, I'm under control. And even so much as, you know, the vast majority of women, when they come to me with their breast cancer diagnosis, the first thing they say to me is, I'm healthy, except I have breast cancer.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so little connection between where they are with their health. And it feels completely normal and acceptable for them to say, I'm healthy, but I have breast cancer. And there's total and utter disconnect. And listen, I'm not saying that these people are doing anything wrong. They're not.
Right.
So often we have no awareness what we're doing is harmful to our health. And oftentimes the things that we do that end up being detrimental to our health are sold to us as the right thing to do. And we think that we're doing the right thing. We're trusting our experts. So I'll give you two examples. If you were fortunate enough to live through the 80s, then you will know that that is the time when we shifted from fat is good to fat is bad.
Right.
And everything became about fat free. And we replaced fat with sugar. And we have generations of heart disease and diabetes to show for it, right? But where did we get that? We got that from our physicians.
Mm-hmm.
Our physicians told us that fat is bad. And, you know, the food industry was only too happy to help out because the fat fee craze went, you know, stuck.
Right.
People loved it. Listen, I used to eat Snack Wells like they were going out of business.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I bought in hook, line, and sinker and promptly gained 20 pounds. So that's one example. Another example I'll give you is, like, look at the dental industry. Look at the years and years and years that they put metal amalgams in people's mouths or did root canals or fluoride,
yeah.
Right? Like, we all thought that this was the right thing to do. Brush with fluoride toothpaste, you know, have a cavity filled with a metal amalgam, have a root canal because we were told that we needed it. And never did we anticipate that we were setting ourselves up for mercury poisoning, for chronic infections in our mouth from that dead cavity, from the root canal, from having 25% of women having thyroid disease because that fluoride sneaks in there and replaces the iodine in your thyroid hormone. And while your thyroid studies will look normal, you are not normal. And you're not normal. You feel awful, right? Because it may slip in there, but it doesn't work.
Yeah. Do you do much with iodine testing with your clients? I've started doing that within our practice because I know there's a big link between low iodine and fibrocystic breasts and thyroid nodules and all of that. And I'm yet to see normal iodine tests come back. They're all low.
Yeah. It's a confusing topic.
It is.
And there's a lot of different opinions on there. So I'm still in the information gathering phase and I've interviewed a number of experts for my podcast. So I'm going to have a lot to say about that very shortly.
Good, good.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about the different screening options, the thermography versus ultrasound versus mammogram. Like, for example, you know, you're doing a self breast exam, okay? Mm-hmm. You detect a lump or, you know, an area that does not feel normal.
Yeah.
Right? Go to the OBGYN and let's order you a mammogram.
Yeah.
Call to go get the mammogram scheduled. And there's a 2 to 3 month long wait. That's a common scenario.
I wish it were longer. Let me first preface by saying that something that you said in the very beginning.
Yeah.
You talked about preventative breast cancer screening and there's no such thing.
Okay.
So I want to be very clear that when I talk about prevention, I talk about things like eating a whole food, plant-based, nutrient-dense, low-glycemic diet, because that seems to be the one that is most beneficial for everyone. Where you get your protein is up to you. This isn't about politics for me.
Right.
I don't talk about being a vegan because, first of all, as I'm frequently reminded, Twizzlers are vegan, and I am not a proponent of including Twizzlers in your diet. But I am a proponent of eating real food because it's the only thing our bodies understand. Mm-hmm. And when we give our body processed food, it doesn't know what to do with it, and it causes inflammation.
Right.
And it is a surefire way to take your immune system out of the picture because 70% of our immune system lives in our gut.
Mm-hmm.
And it is constantly being charged with determining if what you're eating is food or not. And if you're eating processed food, it's not food.
Right.
And your immune system is stuck saying, oh my God, now what? Now what is this? So making sure that you're eating a whole food diet where you get your protein from is up to you. Next, movement, because sitting really is the new smoking. Your body is yours to have or to lose. And if you don't move your body, you are going to lose it. Our bodies were meant to move. We were meant to walk hours and hours and hours every single day. And now we're sitting for hours and hours and hours every day. I'm as guilty of it as anyone else.
Right.
I spend most of my time during the day up on my treadmill at my treadmill desk, but mm-hmm. it's very annoying to be on a podcast and have someone on a treadmill. I've done it multiple times with having my guests be on a treadmill. It drives me berserk. So I don't do that to other people, but movement is so important, and that movement needs to change a little bit as you get older. So as you get north of 40, 45, certainly 50, maintaining muscle mass is the way to maintain your metabolism. And this is all about metabolic health. Mm-hmm. We must have metabolic health. And the only way to have metabolic health is to maintain your muscle. And in order to do that, you have to have enough protein in your diet, yes, but you have to demand on those muscles. So you have to lift heavy things. You have to. It's unavoidable. And I am someone, I'll tell you, I am a lifelong non-exerciser. I've been an athlete my whole life, but dedicated exercise is a nightmare for me. Do I love to take a 5-mile walk outside on a beautiful day? Yes. If you tell me that I have to go to the gym and lift weights every single day, it's like Groundhog Day for me. It's the same nightmare over and over and over again. Jen Moore, my trainer and dear friend, I love you. And you know how much I hate to see you every week.
Thank you for normalizing that too.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't hate it more.
That's okay.
But I do it because I know that that is the only way. And I had a major, major setback last year when I needed to have spine surgery. And there's nothing that will derail your health like 3 months in a chair recuperating from spine surgery. So I am literally clawing my way back to health. Mm-hmm. And I hate the 2 and 3 days a week that I have to get into the gym, but I got to do it.
Yeah.
Right. Because the alternative is unacceptable. And I am not going to lose my body and I'm not going to lose my function. And by the way, if you don't maintain your body, you lose your mind too.
Mm-hmm.
Because part of aging is that loss of connection between your brain and your body. And the surefire way of have that happen is to be sedentary.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to move, and we have to move in a way that's meaningful. So we have to both have that cardiovascular activity, whatever it is, but we also have to do strength training. We have to do flexibility and we have to do balance. That's what keeps the mind connected to the body. So that's movement. We have to prioritize sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Sleep is where the healing happens. So if you're not sleeping, you're not healing. And there is no path to health if you're not sleeping at night. And incidentally, there is a definite path to disease. And we know that short sleepers, people who sleep less than 6 or 7 hours a night, are vulnerable for a host of chronic diseases, including cancer. So sleep is an absolute must. Controlling the toxins in your environment.
Yes.
We only have so much capability to process toxins. And for the purposes of our discussion, I feel obligated to mention alcohol in that category.
Yes.
Because we have normalized drinking so much in our society. And the American Cancer Society has said that there is no safe amount of alcohol for women. And if you are actively cancering, you need to abide by that. It's just not safe. It's not safe for so many reasons. And if you have had cancer and you have recovered and you have achieved metabolic health, if you want to have an occasional drink, that's fine. It probably won't hurt you in the long run, but you should definitely not make a habit of it.
It should not be on a weekly basis. It should never be on consecutive days. And it shouldn't be more than one. And mm-hmm. as we get older, we all start to feel that more because your liver only has so much capability. Mm-hmm. And when you exceed that liver's capability, you're going to feel it and it's going to take a toll on your health. So toxins, including alcohol, it's very, very important to control the amount that you're exposed to and to improve your detoxification practices. So managing the stress in healthy ways, as we said, not alcohol, not pills, but having real tools in your toolbox to help you to manage the stress so that you're spending most of your time in parasympathetic mode and only a fraction of your time, a small fraction of your time in that sympathetic mode. Because we need that sympathetic mode, right? I just wrote a book, right? I needed to call on all of that additional energy because, like my ancestors before me, I had a desert to cross. I had an ocean to cross. Like anyone who has taken on a major project like that, you know, it takes that extra. It takes that extra. But then the voyage has to be over. You can't go from writing one book to the next. You can't do it. It's bad for your physiology. We have to have that time to rest, repair, and regenerate. So those are the drivers of health. And that's what I think about when we talk about prevention.
Okay.
Screening is a different story. Screening is early detection. Mm-hmm. It's finding a disease when it's already there, hopefully in its infancy. But the problem with breast cancer is that breast cancer doesn't follow the rules. So our mammographic screening program, which started in 1970, was built on a very logical assumption. It assumed that breast cancer growth was both linear and predictable. So it assumed that breast cancer started small and grew to some critical size, at which point it was more likely to metastasize. And if you could find that cancer before it hit that critical mass, you could save lives and save breasts. And again, lovely theory, totally logical, just doesn't happen to be true.
Okay. Okay. Tell us more.
Breast cancer growth is neither linear nor predictable. Breast cancer biology is what it is from the very beginning. So if you're going to have an aggressive process, it's possible to find an aggressive process when it's small, but you're not going to change that process. That process is going to be aggressive. And with rare exception, no matter what you do, that person is not going to have a good outcome. And then there are very big tumors that no matter what you do, that person's going to be fine from a breast cancer perspective, and then everything in between. So when we look at mammograms, let's talk about what actually happens with them, because no matter how many mammograms we do every year, the same exact number of women present with aggressive disease. No matter how many mammograms we do every year, the same exact number of women will die of breast cancer. We are not impacting the bottom line. Here's what we are doing. We're diagnosing a lot of women with breast cancer for disease that would never have affected their lives, would never have changed the duration of their lives. But in making them breast cancer patients, we have tremendously negatively impacted their lives. So we're definitely not saving breasts. The mastectomy rate only goes up and up.
Uh-huh.
And when a woman undergoes a mastectomy, most of the time she does that out of fear. She does it with an understanding that she will have less treatment. It's not true at all. She does it with an understanding that she has a decreased risk of dying of breast cancer. Also not true. And those scars from mastectomy, let me tell you, they run deep.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you have a reconstruction, those scars run deep. If you have a mastectomy, even with a beautiful reconstruction, and I worked with some super duper talented people in my time as a surgeon. I made beautiful breasts, beautiful. There will never come a time where that woman won't remember that she had breast cancer for the rest of her life. But if you have a lumpectomy, a well-done lumpectomy, I guarantee you there will come a time where you will be able to put that diagnosis behind you. And living with that diagnosis for the rest of your days, that's a certain kind of hell.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is. It truly is. It affects you on so many levels. You know, when people have a cancer that is inside of their body, they get to a place where they barely remember anymore because it's not something that they had to share with the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
But ask any woman what it's like to go through breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Because her sexuality comes into play, her femininity comes into play, her appearance comes into play, her ability to feed a child comes into play. I mean, you know, when we have 30-year-olds and 20-year-olds being diagnosed with breast cancer, we have to think about this.
Oh, yeah.
Think about this. So there are so many aspects to breast cancer that are unique to breast cancer. And when you diagnose a woman with breast cancer and commit her to treatment, you're committing her to a lot of things because most of the treatments for breast cancer accelerate heart disease,
mm-hmm.
accelerate bone loss, accelerate brain disease. They're associated with depression, anxiety. They change the quality of your genitourinary system. They completely abolish your libido. So these things have profound effects both on your health and the health of your relationships. And we're not taking this into account. We are not counseling women adequately on this. And, you know, for the 40-some thousand women a year who are diagnosed with DCIS, which stands for ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a horrible misnomer because we should not be calling it cancer when it's not. And these women undergo mastectomy or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually take a disease which would never have threatened their life. And they're dying younger.
And this is partially happening because they're getting mammograms done preventatively.
Yes.
And it's picked up on a mammogram and then it's like, oh, we've got to biopsy it, right?
Is that the step?
And then
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And even for the women that don't get a cancer diagnosis, 75% of the biopsies that we do are benign. And yet these women now get put into this high risk category because mm-hmm. they've had a breast biopsy.
And they're right? told to and get so, a mammogram once to twice a year.
That's right. So now we're radiating them more frequently and we're virtually guaranteeing that they get there someday.
What are your thoughts on thermography versus ultrasound instead of doing the mammogram or the MRI?
Yeah. So first of all, I think that MRI is a totally inappropriate screening tool.
Mm-hmm.
And I think both of those screening programs, both the mammographic screening program and the MRI screening program, need to be abolished. The mammogram, because we can't take the healthy population, because that's who's screening, the healthy population, we cannot take them and subject them to radiation. It is so wrong on so many levels. And we are actually causing a certain percentage of breast cancers every year because we are radiating these women. We're causing the breast cancer. We're giving them a disease that they would have never had we not done this. It's horribly irresponsible. And with MRI, MRI's value is only with gadolinium. So we are giving women a heavy metal and they have heavy metal burden. And any time that you put a heavy metal in the body, it's going to be stored. And it's mm-hmm. going to be stored at the expense of something else, something that you need. And it's going to cause tissue damage. There's no avoiding that. So again, we can't even in the high-risk population, they're still healthy. They're still the healthy population. We should not be subjecting them to things that cause disease. It's the wrong thing to do. So you ask me, what do I do about screening? First of all, I completely believe in self-breast examination.
Mm-hmm.
I think that no one is ever going to know you better than you know yourself. And I think we have an obligation to know ourselves, right? Like, we need to be in charge of our own bodies. And we know when something's wrong. We know that something's different. And that is the time that we need to advocate for ourselves. And if you can't get someone to listen to you, go to someone else. Because if you feel like something's wrong, something's wrong. I trust patient intuition more than anything else. Whenever one of my patients comes to me with something, believe me, I'm listening. I'm not dismissing. I am not saying, maybe it's just, maybe it's just, maybe it's just. I'm listening. Because if they are thinking about it enough to bring it to me, it's a something. And I'm trying to figure out what that something is. And I want to be clear, while I don't believe in mammogram for the screening healthy population, I'm not an idiot. I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
I know that we have medical advances. Now, mammogram isn't a great one in that it will miss 40% of cancers in dense-breasted women, which is 40% of the population. But that's when we're using it as a screening tool. When we're using it as a diagnostic tool, it does a little better.
Right.
And if you're in that diagnostic population, meaning that we're talking about someone who has already said, I'm not normal. I feel something.
Okay.
Something's different. Something's changed. This is a diagnostic study now. And with a diagnostic study, we can do more. We can look closer. We can do an ultrasound along with it.
Do you think ultrasound by itself can be enough for diagnostic to then prompt a biopsy so we can avoid the mammogram radiation?
Well, in my opinion, yes.
Okay.
In my opinion, I don't think that the mammogram adds anything to it. Because what mammogram sees that ultrasound doesn't is DCIS, it's non-invasive cancer. And quite frankly, I think that that's an area that we don't need to know so much about.
Okay. Okay.
We just, it's not going to long-term change anything. So why are we chasing it? And if it's going to develop into an invasive cancer, then the invasive cancer is going to turn up and we'll deal with the invasive cancer. But to treat all of those women for DCIS, those 40,000 women for DCIS, when only a fraction of them are going to go on and develop invasive cancer, but we're committing all of those women to treatment and we are shortening the duration and significantly lowering the quality of their life.
Yeah.
For what?
Absolutely.
It's not worth it. Certainly not worth it to them. Maybe worth it to the system, right? Because breast cancer care is big business. But it's not worth it to the individual. And the individual is really the one that's paying the price. So I'm a huge believer in self-breast examination. I like thermography, but not for breast cancer screening.
Okay.
Thermography detects a heat signal.
Right.
So it is powered to find inflammation. Now, sometimes that inflammation is associated with a breast cancer. And sometimes the inflammation is just inflammation that hasn't manifested anything yet. In that instance, you know what you have? Opportunity.
Absolutely.
You have opportunity to figure out what is happening with your body. You're being given a gift. Here's the opportunity to say, wait, something's going on. Let's fix it, right? Let's figure out where that inflammation is coming from. Let's correct that. So that you don't have to go on to fail. Our medical system currently is built on failure. We are only powered to determine failure. And there is a whole spectrum of dysfunction before you get to failure. And that's what I love about functional medicine so much is that our goal is optimal function. So if you are suboptimal, you don't have to fail for us to pay attention to you.
Right.
You just have to be suboptimal. And we say, like, here you go. Let's lift you up. You stumbled a little bit. Let's lift you up. But you don't have to be broken down on the ground for us to help you. But that's what's happening in the conventional medical system, is they're not helping people until they fail. One of my best friends just had lab work, and her A1C was elevated, and her fasting glucose was elevated. I had asked her to ask her doctor if he would measure a fasting insulin. He said no.
Yeah, what's with that?
Other, Same whole other story.
Yeah. And so, you know, when her A1C came back a little elevated and her fasting glucose was, you know, 99 or 101 or whatever it was, because she doesn't meet their criteria for diabetes, what did he say? Well, just follow it, right? Let's wait until you're diabetic, and then we'll retest give you insulin, right?
Come back in 6 months. We'll retest you.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
But there's so much opportunity there. There's so much opportunity. So thermography is a great way. And I don't just do thermograms of the breast. I recommend the whole body because it's a great way of knowing what's happening in your body. And if you have inflammation, it's your opportunity to work on it. And that's great. That's awesome. Now, if you do have inflammation in the area of the breast, then I certainly recommend that that get paired with an ultrasound, because you want to know if something's there right now and if something needs attention right now.
Okay.
And there are a couple of instances of breast cancer where I do think that it needs immediate attention. And those are if you have inflammatory breast cancer, but that's something that you're going to know, because that's someone who goes from having a normal breast to a breast full of tumor that is red and hot and swollen in a matter of a month, right? So that's something that's very obvious. If you have breast cancer and you have metastatic disease to a bone that is fractured, that's something that needs immediate attention because you're in a tremendous amount of pain. That happens a lot with the spine, but it can. I've seen it happen with the femur, with the scapula, with the humerus. I've seen this happen over the years. When someone is suffering in pain, there's no path to healing. And so if someone has a pathologic fracture, we have to help them right away.
Right.
Get them out of pain and to get them on the path to healing. And then the third instance is if you have brain metastasis, because the skull is a fixed space. So when you have brain metastasis, not only do you have growth of the brain in that, you know, the brain is larger because of the tumor, but you also get edema. You get swelling of the brain tissue. And if you swell the brain too much, it will cut off circulation to the brain. And that is not compatible with life. So we definitely want to recognize that as early as possible and seek treatment. Other than those three instances, there are no emergencies in breast cancer. They feel like emergencies, right? It's an emotional emergency for sure. But other than those three instances, there are no physical emergencies in breast cancer. And breast cancer, by and large, unless it's a very aggressive process, has been going on for years. And so, you know, I have people message me all the time, I need a QT scan. And we'll talk about QT in a little bit. I need a QT scan. I need to have a study. I need to have a biopsy. I need to. It feels like you need to. And I get it in this day and age where we are so used to immediate answers, right? Mm-hmm. We are the Google generation. Although people ask me all questions all the time that I think could be so easily Googled. But we are the immediate gratification generation, right? Like we want it and we want it now.
Absolutely.
But we don't need it now. And the best gift I can give to people who have a breast cancer diagnosis is, and I wrote about this in my book, take a breath.
Yeah.
Take a pause. Gather your information, do your research, assemble your team. Make sure that you know what you have. Make sure you know what you're agreeing to, right? Because whatever decision that you're going to make, you're going to live with for a very long time. And I want it to be the right decision for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to feel good about whatever you decided. And the last thing I want is for someone who is just listening to me now, made their decision 2 years ago, and now in this moment, regretting your decision. Right. I do not want that. You made the best decision you could with the information you had at the time. And whether that was a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and you're just learning about me now, good, because you have the opportunity now to live the rest of your life differently than you lived before.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, that's what this is all about, making tomorrow better than today and seizing the opportunities that life puts in front of us. They aren't always welcome opportunities. I for sure never wanted to get sick, and I don't want to go back to that person that I was 5 years ago. I don't want to feel like that again. I don't want to experience that again. And God willing, I won't.
Mm-hmm.
And if I do, I'll just know that there's a message there and that I need to do better. And that's okay too, right? Because I know that God is always going to put what I can handle in front of me. But we just need to know that we always make the best decisions we can with the information that we have at the time. And it's about continuing to be true to that and continuing to search for the information that resonates with you. Because listen, my voice doesn't resonate with everyone.
Right.
Not everyone wants to take control. Not everyone wants to be an active participant. There are plenty of people who want the pill or the drug or the procedure or the whatever it is that they're being offered because it's easier for them, because it makes them feel safe to be in someone else's hands, because it is absolutely terrifying to think that you can control this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. Whatever you decide for you is okay because you're making the right decision for you. Because at the end of the day, I have to live with my decisions and you have to live with yours.
This was so good. Yeah, I do want to discuss about the QT imaging, if you still have time.
Yeah.
I know that you had that done in January. You went out to San Francisco, right?
I did. And I got to experience the QT scan for myself.
Yeah.
It was an amazing experience. It's like an 18-minute meditation. You know,
not painful.
Not painful. I've had plenty of mammograms in my life because, you know, I really did not wake up to what it means to truly be a doctor, a healer, to what healthcare should actually be. I didn't wake up to that till I was 50 years old. And coming from a breast cancer family, I had plenty of mammograms.
Right.
So for me, I knew what a mammogram was like. I knew what that whole experience was like, beyond the fear, beyond the pain. Like I knew the whole thing. And I had even had a breast biopsy before. So I was very well schooled on that path. And I went to San Francisco to have my QT scan, and it could not have been more beautiful. The tech was amazing, but the process, the procedure is amazing. I mean, you just literally submerge your breast in a water bath and lie there for 9 minutes per side. And, you know, I got my results the next day, and it was an amazing experience and so different than anything that we've had before. And knowing that there is absolutely no danger, it is 100% safe. It has 40 times the resolution of MRI. So, awesome. You know, there's amazing specificity to it, whereas MRI has so many false positives. It's really a relief, and it's going to forever change how we screen for breast cancer. So I'm so lucky to have been introduced to it so early in my process, and I'm just making it my life's mission to make sure that everyone who wants access to a QT scan gets access to a QT scan. So I'm really out there talking about it as much as I possibly can.
Do you think that we're going to see access to that happen in the next few years, or do you think that's going to take a while?
100%.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Awesome. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. They'll be readily available within the next 5 years, hopefully within the next 3.
Awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'm going to link in the notes for where people can find you. Instagram. I'm going to tag your Instagram and your website. Is there anything else, anywhere else anyone should find you or follow? And,
so I have my own podcast. It's called Keeping Abreast with Dr. Jen. We release a new episode every Monday. So if you like what you heard, you can hear hours and hours of me. And I'm also, we put everything up on YouTube. So Dr. Jen Simmons. On Instagram and Facebook, Dr. Jen Simmons. We also have a free Facebook group called Keeping Abreast with Dr. Jen that you can join and be part of our community. And my book will be released on May 7th, The Smart Woman's Guide to Breast Cancer. So make sure that you pick that up along with the companion journal. And I'm just praying that this book does exactly what I intended it to do, which is to help millions and millions of women. Who we have 6 million women living in the US today with a breast cancer diagnosis. And I hope that this can help them to reclaim their health and live the lives that they want to live. And just remember that my Jen has 2 N's.
Thank you. I love it. I'm excited to pick that book. I'll definitely be grabbing that.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Thank you for listening to the Fueled and Free podcast. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Learn more at margaretannpowell.com and follow me on Instagram at margaretannpowell.